Chapter 7. Berry Conway came round the corner into Mulberry Grove and paused outside the gate of the Nook to fumble in his pocket for his latchkey. In the fading sunlight of the summer evening, Mulberry Grove was looking its best and most pastoral. A gentle breeze whispered through the trees, and in the ornamental water, which shone like an opal, one of the swans was standing on its head, while the other moved to and fro in a slow, thoughtful sort of way, like a man hunting for a lost collar stud. It would seem, in short, almost incredible that anyone would have seen the place at this particular moment without instantly being reminded of the island valley of Avilion, where falls not hail nor rain nor any snow, nor ever wind blows loudly. But if this comparison presented itself to the mind of Berry Conway, he gave no sign of it. He eyed Mulberry Grove with dislike. He frowned at the trim little house. At the two swans, Egbert and Percy, he glowered. And when, from the premises of the Valley Fields Lawn Tennis Club, there was borne to his ears the happy yapping of eager flappers, he groaned slightly and winced, like Prometheus watching his vulture dropping in for lunch. The inexplicable removal from his life of the only girl he had ever loved or could love had made existence a weary affair for Berry these days. Having found his key, he entered the house and went to his bedroom. There he removed his clothes and, putting on a dressing gown, proceeded to the bathroom. He splashed about in cold water for a while, then, returning to the bedroom, began to don the costume of the English gentleman about to dine. For tonight was the night of the annual banquet of the old boys of his school. And though, since his entry into the ranks of the wage slaves, he had preferred to lead a hermit existence and avoid as far as possible the companions of his opulent days, some lingering sentimentality still caused him to turn out for these functions. He had just completed his toilet when a knock sounded on the door. He had expected it sooner. He opened the door, congratulating himself as he did so that he had finished tying his tie. Otherwise, the faithful old retainer would have insisted on doing it for him.
"I didn't hear you come in, Master Berry," said the old retainer, beaming. "How nice you look. Would you like me just to straighten your tie?"
"Go ahead," said Berry resignedly.
"I always think a tie looks so different when you straighten it."
"I know what you mean," said Berry. "Straighter."
"That's it. Straighter. Gladys at Castlewood tells me," said the old retainer, beginning the news bulletin, "that they had burglars there this afternoon. She says she's never seen the Major look so purple. It was her afternoon out, she says, and when she came home, he was walking round and round the garden with a pistol in his hand, muttering to himself. He was very cross, Gladys tells me. Well, I mean, enough to make any gentleman cross, having men break into his house and steal his caps."
"Did somebody steal that cap of the Major's?" asked Berry, brightening. He had disliked the thing for 18 months.
"They did, Master Berry, and somebody else broke two of the back windows with a stone.
Mulberry Grove is looking up."
"But it's all right," said Mrs. Wisdom soothingly. "I've had a word with Mr. Finbow, and he's promised to keep an eye on us."
"Who's Mr. Finbow?"
"He's a gentleman in the police, and though Mulberry Grove, he says, isn't strictly speaking on his beat, he will make a point, he says, of looking in every now and then to see that we're all right. I thought very civil of him and gave him a slice of cake. In all, it seems that Mr. Finbow comes from the very same part of the country where I used to live when I was a slipper of a girl. I always say it's a small world after all."
"Well, I mean, when I say the very same part of the country, my dear father and mother had a cottage in Herefordshire, and Mr. Finbow lived in Birmingham, but it does seem odd all the same.
We had a nice talk. Would you like me to get a brush and give you a good brushing, Master Berry?"
"No, thanks," said Berry hastily. "I haven't time. I must hurry. If I miss the 6:50, I shall be late for my dinner."
"Be careful not to overeat yourself, dear."
"Don't worry, I'm not as hungry as all that."
"I mean to say, it's so dangerous to sit in a draughty railway carriage with the pores open."
"I'll shut them," said Berry. "Goodbye." He charged out of the house, causing his next-door neighbour, Lord Biscuiton, to utter a startled cry of admiration. Biscuit at the moment was engaged in weeding his front garden, a pursuit which, like a good householder, he had taken up with energy. "Golly," said the Biscuit, eyeing his friend's splendour open-mouthed. "Giving the populace a thorough treat, are you not? What is it? Meat tea at Buckingham Palace?" "OB dinner," explained Berry briefly, "and if you weren't a slacker, you'd be coming too." The Biscuit shook his head. "Never again for me," he said. "Not any more of those binges for me. I know them too well. The committee of management either stick you in among a drove of dotards, who talk across you about the time they were given a half holiday because of the Battle of Crecy, or else you get dumped down with a lot of kids whose heads you want to smack. And it's a very moot point which of the two situations is the fouler. I was with the kids last time. I'll swear some of them had come in prams. Have you noticed, Berry, old man, how extraordinarily young everybody seems to be nowadays? That's because we're getting on. Silver threads among the gold, laddie. How old are you?"
26 next birthday.
"Pretty senile," said the Biscuit, clicking his tongue and jabbing at a weed. "Pretty senile. And the year after that you'll be 27, and then, if I've got my figures correct, 28. Just waiting for the end, you might say. It's no use kidding ourselves, old friend. We're ageing rapidly, and our place is by the hearth."
"You won't come, then?"
"No, I shall remain here and stroll in my garden. Quite possibly little Kitchy Valentine will be strolling in hers, and we'll exchange ideas across the fence. I maintain that in the suburbs it's a duty to cultivate one's neighbours. There is in English life too much of this ridiculous keeping of oneself to oneself. I deprecate it."
It did not take very long. Once the company had seated itself in the Oriental banquet room of the Hotel Mazarin in Piccadilly, to realise which of the two alternatives mentioned by the Biscuit was to be his fate tonight. Dotards in considerable force had attended this old boy's dinner, but they were sitting at distant tables. His own was the very heart and centre of the younger set. Boisterous striplings, who all seemed to know one another intimately and have no desire to know him at all, encompassed him on every side, and gradually, as he watched them, his mood of sombre sadness deepened. He knew now that he had made a mistake in exposing himself to this ordeal. He was in no frame of mind to suffer gladly beardless juveniles like these. Swollen with soup, they had now begun to rollick and frolic in a manner infinitely distressing to a heartbroken elder. Their infantile frivolity affected him more and more every moment with a sense of the passage of the years. Once, he reflected, how long ago, he too had had spirits like that. Once he, also, had lived in Arcady and thrown bread at old boys' dinners. How far in the distant past all that sort of thing lay now. 26 next birthday. That was what he was. 26, and no getting away from it. And what had he done with his life? Nothing, apart from being the sort of chump who, when he has the luck to meet the only girl in the world, lets her slip away from him like a dream at daybreak. What had he achieved? Nothing. If he were to pass away tonight, poisoned, let us say, by this peculiar-looking fish which, having died of some unknown complaint, had just been placed before him by an asthmatic waiter, what sort of gap would he leave? An almost invisible one. Scarcely a dimple. Would that girl regret him? Most unlikely. Would she even remember that she'd ever met him? Probably not. A wonderful girl like that met so many men. Why should she have continued to bear in mind so notably inferior a specimen as himself? Such a girl could take her pick of all that was best and brightest of England's masculinity. Hers was a life spent in the centre of a whirling maelstrom of handsome, dashing devils with racing Bentleys and all the money in the world. What earthly reason had he supposed that she had ever given him another thought? A doddering wreck like him? 26 next birthday? In a flash of morbid intuition, he realised now why she'd driven off that day and left him flat. It was because she was bored with him and had jumped at the chance of getting away while his back was turned. He had reached this depth of self-torment and was preparing to go still deeper when half a roll, propelled by a vigorous young hand,
struck him smartly on the left ear.
He leapt convulsively, and for an instant forgot all about the girl. In similar circumstances, Dante would have forgotten Beatrice. The roll was one of those hard, jagged rolls, and the effect of its impact was not unlike that of a direct hit from a shell. He looked up wrathfully, and as he did so, a child at the other end of the table, smirking apologetically, applied the last straw.
"Oh, sorry, sir," cried this babe and suckling. "Frightfully sorry, sir. Most awfully sorry, sir. I was aiming at young dog's body."
Berry contrived to smirk back, but with an infinite wryness, for his heart was as lead. This, he felt, was the end. The young germ had called him sir. Sir! He was what he himself called T. Patterson Frisby, that genuine museum piece who could not be a day less than 50. Now he saw everything. Now he understood. That girl had been civil to him at first because she was a sweet, kind-hearted girl who'd been taught always to be polite to age. What he had mistaken for camaraderie had been merely the tolerance demanded by his white hairs. Right from the start, no doubt, she'd been saying to herself, "At the very earliest opportunity, I must shake this old buster." And at the very earliest opportunity, she had done so. Sir, indeed, how right the biscuit had been. He should never have been such a fool as to come to this blasted creche, and the best thing he could do, having come, was to repair his blunder by oiling out immediately. To leave a public dinner at the height of its fever is not easy, and it is to be doubted whether mere senile gloom, however profound, would have been enough to nerve Berry to the task. But at this moment his eye fell on the table at the top of the room, along which, on either side of the president, were seated some 20 of the elect, and it now flashed upon him that of these, at least 8 must almost certainly be intending to make speeches. And right in the middle of them, with a nasty, vicious look in his eye, sat a bishop. Anybody who's ever attended old boys' dinners knows that bishops are tough stuff. They take their time, these prelates. They mouth their words and shape their periods. They roam with frightful deliberation from the grave to the gay, from the manly straightforward to the whimsically jocular. Not one of them but is good for at least 25 minutes. Berry hesitated no longer. The banquet had reached the petrified quail stage now, which meant that there was only the hair oil ice cream, the embalmed sardines on toast, and the arsenical coffee to go, before the dam of oratory would burst. There was not an instant to be lost. He pushed his chair back and sidled furtively to the door. He reached the door and pulled it open. He slid through and closed it behind him. He was standing now in the main lobby of the hotel. Festive-looking men and women were passing through, some to the dining room whence strains of music proceeded, others to the lifts. There seemed to be a dance or some other sort of entertainment in progress upstairs somewhere, for traffic on the lifts was heavy. Revellers were being taken up in dozens, and Berry watched them with a growing feeling of desolation and disapproval. Their light-heartedness irked him, as the exuberance of his recent companions in the Oriental banquet room had irked him. It is not pleasant, when one is face to face with one's soul, to see a lot of fatheads enjoying themselves. Berry had achieved by this time a frame of mind which would have qualified him to walk straight into a Chekhov play and no questions asked, and he resented all this idiotic gaiety. As the crackling of thorns under a pot, he felt, so is the laughter of a fool. An unusually large consignment was on the point of starting now. The lift was crammed with perishers of both sexes, the girls giggling and the men wot-wotting in a carefree manner that made him feel sick. So full was it that it scarcely seemed as if there'd be room for the girl in the green opera cloak who was hurrying with her escort across the lobby. But the man at the wheel contrived to squeeze them in somehow, and as the car started on its journey, the girl turned to her companion and said something with a smile. And for the first time, Berry saw her face. And as he saw it, the lobby rocked about him. A wordless exclamation burst from his lips. Reeling, he clutched at a passing waiter.
Sir? Said the waiter, courteously ceasing to pass. Berry smiled radiantly at the man. He could only see him through a sort of mist, but he was able to realise that this was, by a considerable margin, the nicest-looking waiter he'd ever set eyes on. And all those people in the lifts, how wrong he had been, he now saw, in thinking of them as perishers. They were in reality a most extraordinarily jolly crowd, and how capital it was to think that they were enjoying themselves so much. "What's going on up there?" he asked. The waiter informed him that Sir Herbert and Lady Bassinger were giving a ball in the Crystal Room on the first floor. "Ah," said Berry thoughtfully, "a ball, eh?" He handed the man half a crown and stood for a moment gazing wistfully across the lobby. How splendid, he was thinking, it would have been if only he had been acquainted with these Bassingers. Then they might have invited him. Berry pulled himself up with a start. He was shocked to find that for an instant he'd been allowing himself to fall so far from the standard of a man of enterprise, dash, and resource as to look on a card of invitation as an essential preliminary to the enjoyment of the hospitality of Sir Herbert and Lady Bassinger. But it had been merely a passing weakness. He was himself again now, and what he felt was that any ballroom, Bassinger or non-Bassinger, where that girl was to be found, was Liberty Hall for him. The lift had just descended and was standing on the ground floor once more, waiting for custom. Berry pulled down his waistcoat and walked towards it with resolute steps. Lady Bassinger's ball at the Hotel Mazarin was an entertainment to which Anne Moon had been looking forward with pleasurable anticipation. Toddy Malling, the young man who, in the unfortunate absence of her fiancé, Lord Biscuiton, was acting as her escort, had been almost lyrical about it in the car. It promised, said Toddy, to be the jamboree of the season. Champagne, he assured her, always flowed like water where the Bassingers set up their banner. "Old B," said Toddy, "is not the sort of fellow I care to go on a walking tour with, but at providing refreshment for man and beast, he has few equals. He made about 10 million quid in the clove market, and God bless cloves, say I," he added devoutly. On Toddy's suggestion, they had made straight for the supper room. He held the view, for which there was much to be said, that it was silly to think of doing any hoof shaking till they'd stoked up. Having deposited Anne at a table for two, he had gone off to forage, and now she was sitting, waiting for him to come back, and as she watched the crowd, she wished that she could achieve something of the hearty party spirit which so obviously animated Sir Herbert and Lady Bassinger's other guests. She was conscious of a feeling of flatness ill-attuned to the rollicking note of the festivities. It was strange, she reflected. Her conscience assured her that the most sensible thing she'd ever done in her life was to drive off in her car and leave that attractive young man to catch his sniffers for himself. She was engaged, Conscience pointed out, and girls who had plighted their troth must not hobnob with handsome Secret Service men. And yet, so far from experiencing the glow of satisfaction which good girls are entitled to expect, she was feeling as if she'd deliberately thrown away something wonderful and precious. In torturing himself with the thought that this girl had forgotten him, Berry Conway had tortured himself unnecessarily. "Bollinger, one bot," said Toddy Malling, appearing suddenly at her side. "I snaffled it off another table. Stick to it like glue and guard it with your life." The supper room was looking now like a popular store during a bargain sale. The idea of taking refreshment before dancing had not occurred to Toddy alone. On every side, thrustful cavaliers, like knights jousting for their ladies, were hurling themselves into the dense throng that masked the table where food and drink were being doled out. Supper at a Bassinger ball was always a test of manhood, and the lucky ones were those who had played rugby football at school. "Somewhere in the heart of the mob," said Toddy, laying his precious burden on the table, "there is provender of sorts. I'll try to get you something. I can't guarantee what it'll be, but are you more or less prepared for whatever I can snitch?" "Anything," said Anne. She came out of her thoughts with a little jump. I'm not hungry.
"You're not," said her escort incredulously. "Gosh, I could eat old Bassinger in person if a spot of chutney went with him. I'll try to hook a chicken. Amuse yourself somehow while I'm gone, and if I don't come back, you know I died game."
He disappeared again, and Anne returned to her thoughts. Yes, something wonderful and precious, and she had thrown it away, and its going had left life flat and monotonous. And that was odd, too, because she never supposed that anything could make life seem monotonous. She had always had the enviable gift of being able to enjoy. Even when in the midst of the Clarence Dumfries and surrounded by the Twombly Burwashes, she had never really been bored. But now, beyond a doubt, she was. And it seemed to her that, except during that short summer afternoon's ride, she always had been. That ride stood out in her memory like an oasis in a desert, the solitary break in a dull and unprofitable existence. The crowd was surging to and fro. Sharp, anguished cries rang through the room as men balancing plates of salmon mayonnaise perceived men with plates of chicken salad backing into them. The heat and the noise combined to induce in Anne a distant dreaminess. Dimly she became aware that somebody was sitting down in the chair opposite her, and she roused herself to protect the rights of the absent Toddy.
"I'm sorry, that chair is—"
She broke off. She was not dreaming now. Her whole body was tingling as though fire had touched it. "Oh!" said Anne breathlessly. And that, for a while, was all she was able to say. Her heart was racing, and already conscience was beginning to comment on the deplorable way in which her lips had begun to tremble. "All wrong," said conscience rebukingly. "This man is nothing but a casual acquaintance. Treat him as such. Bow stiffly." Anne did not bow stiffly. She went on staring. And across the table, the intruder went on staring. A young man in spectacles, bearing treasure trove on a plate, tripped over somebody's foot and bumped heavily into the table. Something fell squashily between them.
"My cutlet, I think," said the young man, retrieving it. "Awfully sorry."
He passed on, and Anne found herself able to smile a tremulous smile.
"Good evening," she said.
"Good evening."
"You do keep popping up, don't you?" said Anne. "You always seem to appear from nowhere, out of a trap."
Her companion did not smile. There was something forceful and urgent about him. He conveyed the impression of one who is in a hurry and in no mood for light conversation. "Where did you get to that day?" he asked abruptly, and frowned as if at an unpleasant memory. Anne braced herself to be cool and quelling. She told herself that she resented his tone. He had spoken as if he supposed he had some claim on her, regarding her as something belonging to him. This, she told herself, offended her, and rightly.
"I went home," she said.
"Why? Isn't a woman's place the home? It was an awful shock when I came out and found you gone."
"I'm sorry."
"I couldn't think where you'd got to."
"Really?"
"The right tone?" asked Anne of her conscience. "Quite right," replied conscience. "Admirable. Keep it up." "By the way," said Anne, "was that man the sniffer?" Her companion stared. For the first time, the forcefulness of his manner was tempered by something that seemed almost embarrassment. A flush had come into his face, and his eyes, instead of gazing piercingly into hers, wandered away to one side. "Look here," he said awkwardly, "I want to tell you something. You see..." He paused.
"Yes?" said Anne.
"I feel I ought to." He appeared to be hovering on the brink of a revelation of some kind.
"Well?" said Anne.
Another young man, this time without spectacles, charged breezily into the table, rocking it to its foundations.
"Frankly sorry," he said. "There's an awful storm going on out here. Heaven help the poor sailors."
He paused to scoop up a portion of chicken salad and went out of their lives forever.
"What were you saying?" asked Anne.
Her companion seemed to have been reflecting during the recent diversion. It had sounded to Anne as though he were about to make some sort of confession, but now he appeared to have thought better of it. "Nothing," he said.
You began to say something about telling me... No, it was nothing. I was going to say something, but I think I won't. You must have your secrets, I suppose. Well, was it the sniffer? No, it wasn't. I'm glad. Why?
A sudden and startling change came over Anne's manner. Until now, she'd won her conscience's complete approval by the distant coolness of her attitude. At this question, she slipped lamentably. From distant coolness, she lapsed into deplorable sincerity.
"I thought you were going into the most terrible danger," she said breathlessly. "I thought he might kill you. You were worried about me?"
"Well, it's not very nice for a respectable young girl," said Anne, recovering, "to be mixed up in shooting affrays. Think of the papers."
The eager light died out of her companion's eyes. "Was that all you cared about?" he asked hollowly. "What else would there be?
Nothing personal in your alarm, eh?"
"Personal?" said Anne, raising her eyebrows.
"Well, I'm glad you did the prudent, sensible thing," said her companion, speaking, however, without noticeable elation, and got away before there was trouble.
"But there wasn't," Anne pointed out.
"No," said her companion, and there was another silence.
Between Anne and her conscience there now existed a wide cleavage of opinion. Her conscience kept telling her that she had borne herself under trying conditions in an exemplary manner. She told herself that she was behaving like an idiot. A little more of this sort of thing, and this man would get up and go away forever. "And a very good thing, too," said conscience. "A most excellent termination to a very unfortunate entanglement."
"Says you," said Anne, and her lips tightened.
Her companion had taken up the bottle of champagne and was shaking it in an overwrought sort of way, a proceeding which would have shocked and horrified Toddy Malling, had he been present, to the core. But Toddy was still far away, battling nobly where the fray was thickest. "Of course I was worried about you," said Anne impulsively. "I only said that about the papers because... Well, of course I was worried about you."
A gleam, like sunshine through cloud rack, illuminated the brooding face opposite her.
"You were? Of course. You mean you were? Certainly. You really were? Of course I was." He leant forward.
"Shall I tell you something?"
"What?"
"Just this," said her companion.
"I..."
He broke off with a sharp exclamation. Something warm and wet had fallen on the back of his head.
"The fault," said a cheerful voice behind him, "is entirely mine. I ought never to have attempted to carry soup through a mob like this. Well, all I can say is, I'm sorry. There's just one bright spot. It's jolly good soup."
Berry turned savagely. A man in love can stand just so much.
"Let's get out of this," he said between his teeth. "There's something I want to tell you. We can't talk here."
"But Mr. Malling will be back in a moment," said Anne. She had a sense of slipping, of struggling for a foothold.
"Who's he? The man I'm with. He's gone to get me something to eat. If I go away, what will he think?"
"If he's anything like the rest of the men here," said Berry, "I don't suppose he's capable of thinking." He urged her towards the door. They passed out and were in a small anteroom. From somewhere beyond came the sound of music. Berry slammed the door behind him and turned to her. "I've something I want to tell you," he said. He seemed to Anne to be swelling before her eyes. He looked huge and intimidating. She became conscious of feeling very small and fragile.
"You'll think me mad, of course."
He was very close to her now, and conscience, clucking like a hen, was urging her to draw back. She did not draw back. He took her hand, and as he did so, she saw him start, like one who has observed a snake in his path. It was her left hand he had taken, and what he was staring at was the ring on the third finger. It was a nice ring of diamonds and platinum, and Lord Biscuiton owed a considerable sum for it. But there was no admiration in the young man's gaze.
"You're engaged," he said.
The words were hardly a question. They resembled more nearly an accusation. Anne had a fleeting but nonetheless disintegrating sensation of having been detected in some act unspeakably low and base. She felt that she wanted to explain, and it seemed so impossible to explain. "Yes," she said, in a small, meek, penitent voice. "My God," said the young man. "Yes," said Anne. "Engaged." "Yes." The young man breathed heavily. "I don't care," he said. "I just want to tell you." The lobby between the supper room and the crystal ballroom of the Hotel Mazarin on the night of the Bassinger dance is perhaps, with the exception of the supper room, the least suitable spot in the whole of London for the conduct of a tête-à-tête. Even as she spoke, the young man became aware of something male and intrusive at his elbow. This person seemed to be desirous of speech with him. He was tapping him on the arm. "Excuse me," he was saying. And almost at the same moment, the door of the supper room flew open, and Anne, in her turn, found herself forced to recognize that there were more than two people in the world. The whole place had begun to take on a congested air. "Oh, there you are," said Toddy Malling. Toddy was flushed and dishevelled. He seemed at some point in his recent activities to have run his right eye up against something hard, for it was watery and half closed. In his left eye, which was working under its normal power, there was the light of reproach. "Oh, there you are," said Toddy Malling. "I couldn't think where you got to. I've been looking for you everywhere." A sense of being torn in half came upon Anne. She felt as she had sometimes felt when wrenched from some beautiful dream by the ringing of the telephone at her bedside. She looked over her shoulder. The young man, who had something which he just wanted to tell her, was standing with a dazed expression on his face, gazing down absently at someone whom she recognized as her host, Sir Herbert Bassinger. Sir Herbert appeared to be asking him some question, and the young man was plainly having a little difficulty in giving his mind to it. "I've snaffled an excellent chicken," proceeded Toddy, with the modest pride of a crusader who has done big things among the Paynim. "Also some salad of sorts. Come along." Anne was a kind-hearted girl, and one who hated hurting people's feelings. Well aware of the perils to which Toddy had exposed himself in order that she might sup, she appreciated the justice of his claim on her society. For her sake he had fought and practically bled. She could not rebuff him now, in the very hour of his triumph. To do so would be to destroy all young Mr. Malling's faith in woman. Besides, there would be plenty of opportunity for resuming that interrupted talk later on, in some more secluded spot. From the solicitous way in which Sir Herbert was patting his arm, it was plain that her mysterious friend must be a favoured guest. She would find him in the crystal ballroom when she had contrived to shake off the insistent Toddy. "All right, Toddy," she said. "You're a hero. Lead on." "You don't mind if young Bertie Winch puts on the noseback with us, do you?" said Toddy anxiously, as they passed through the door. "I had to rope him in as an ally. It was imperative. I stationed him by the table and told him to look after that chicken like a baby sister. Otherwise some of these bally pirates would infallibly have pinched it." Berry, meanwhile, had at last had it forced upon his senses that this voice which was babbling in his immediate neighbourhood was addressing its remarks to him, and though still distrait, he answered civilly. "Quite," he said, "absolutely, no doubt." The voice appeared dissatisfied, and more than dissatisfied, indignant. It rose querulously. "I'm asking you," it said, now undisguisedly peevish, "who the devil you are, and where the devil you come from, and what the devil you think you're doing here. I don't know you from Adam, and I'd like to see your card of invitation, if you please." Berry came out of his reverie. There is a time for dreaming, and a time for facing the issues of life in a practical spirit. This seemed to be one of the latter occasions. Peering through the golden mists which float about a lover, he perceived a rubicund little man of middle age with a walrus moustache and two chins. The moustache was twitching, and both chins waggled in an unpleasant and hostile manner. "I beg your pardon," he said.
"Never mind about begging my pardon," replied his new acquaintance. "Show me your invitation card."
In gazing at Berry as if he were an escape of sewer gas, and addressing him in a tone which a bilious warder in a prison might have used towards a convict whom he didn't like very much, Sir Herbert Bassinger, Bart, undoubtedly had justice on his side. There had been this season at society functions quite an epidemic of what is technically known as gatecrashing. At a great number of balls, that is to say, a great number of London's bright young men had put in an appearance, drunk as much champagne as they could hold without spilling over the brim, and danced till their ankles gave out, all without the formality of an invitation. Hosts had come to dislike this practice. And Sir Herbert Bassinger, who had suffered much from it at his last big affair given earlier in the year, had sworn a dark oath that there was going to be none of that this time. It had accordingly been enjoined upon the guests of the dance in the Crystal Ballroom of the Mazarin Hotel that they should bring their invitation cards with them and be prepared to show them on demand.
"Invitation card," said Berry musingly, as if the word was new to him.
"Invitation card!"
"Well, the fact is," said Berry. It was a conversational gambit which told Sir Herbert all he wanted to know. Only the sinful and black of heart, he was aware, began their remarks with that phrase, comfortably sure now that he was not ejecting from his dance some scion of a noble house whose face he had chanced to forget, or worse, a gossip writer from one of the daily papers. He unmasked his batteries.
"I must request you to leave immediately." "But get out," said Sir Herbert, becoming terser.
"But I must speak to..." The walrus moustache quivered like a cornfield in the evening breeze.
"Are you going, or shall I call a policeman?"
Berry perceived that he must be polite and winning. He was still unaware of the name and address of his goddess in the car, and this man could supply them. He forced an ingratiating smile. It did not go well.
"Don't grin at me!" thundered
Sir Herbert Bassinger. Even filtered through the moustache, his voice made Berry leap a couple of inches. He removed the ingratiating smile. His companion's wish was law. Besides, it was hurting his face. "I'll go," he said reassuringly. "Oh, I'll go. Of course I'll go. I quite understand that I have no business here. I'll go all right. I only came because I saw somebody I wanted to speak to going up in the lift. If you'll just let me go into the supper room and have a word with..." Sir Herbert Bassinger was a man who, when stirred, was accustomed to fall back on a vocabulary of his own invention. He employed it now.
"Stop this tish-tosh!"
Berry continued to be polite and winning. "Perhaps if you would just tell me her name..."
"Enough of this bubble and squeak!"
"Her name," said Berry urgently. "I must know her name. If you'll just be kind enough to tell me her name..."
"Will you kindly cease this tingle-tangle and get out of here?"
said Sir Herbert Bassinger. Several attendants in gay uniform had manifested themselves by now and were dotted about the room, eyeing Berry in that cold, severe way in which barmen eye the obstreperous in bars. Reluctantly, he realized that he could do no more. He had shot his bolt. A brawl, agreeable though it would have been to his ruffled feelings, was out of the question. "Very well," he said. With no more tingle-tangle or tish-tosh, he turned and walked in silence to the stairs. His bearing was not exactly dignified, but it was as dignified as a man's can be who is undergoing a spiritual frog's march. A light in the sitting room of Peacehaven informed Berry on his return to Mulberry Grove that Lord Biskerton was still up and no doubt eager for a chat. He tapped on the window. It was opened hospitably, and he climbed through.
"Well," said the biscuit, "what sort of time did you have?"
He eyed Berry narrowly. There seemed to him in his friend's demeanour something strange, an unwonted sparkle in his eye, a suppressed elation, as of one who on honeymoon has fed and drunk the milk of paradise. This, the biscuit felt, was scarcely to be accounted for by attendance at an old boy's dinner, and he sought elsewhere for the cause.
"What's the matter with you, reptile?" he asked. "You're fizzing visibly. Come into money or something?"
Berry sat down, got up, sat down, got up, sat down again, and got up once more. His manner was feverish, and his host disapproved of it.
"Roost," commanded the biscuit. "Park yourself, confound you. You're making me giddy."
Berry balanced himself on the edge of the horsehair sofa. He did it as one not committing himself definitely to a sitting position, but holding himself in readiness at any moment, should he see fit, to soar up to the ceiling.
"Now then," said the biscuit, "tell me all."
"Biscuit," said Berry, "the most extraordinary thing has happened. There's a gal."
"A gal, eh?" said the biscuit, interested. He began to see daylight. "Who is she?"
"What?" asked Berry, whose attention had wandered.
"I said, who is she?"
"I don't know."
"What's her name?"
"I don't know."
"Where does she live?"
"I don't know."
"You aren't an encyclopedia, old boy, are you?" said the biscuit. "Where did you meet her?"
"I saw her first across a restaurant."
"Well?"
"We looked at one another a good deal."
"And then?"
"Then we went on looking at one another. It was that day you were wearing that beard, biscuit. You remember?"
"I remember."
"I felt absolutely desperate. I knew, just by looking at her, that I'd found the only girl I should ever love."
"You boys," interjected the biscuit tolerantly.
"And how on earth was I to get to know her? That was the problem."
"It always is. I wish I had a quid for every time."
"When I came out into the street, I saw her getting into her car, and suddenly I had an inspiration. I jumped in after her and told her to follow you."
"Follow me? How do you mean me? How do I come into it?"
"You were in the car just ahead."
The biscuit's interest deepened.
"Do you mean all this happened the day you lunched at the Barclay, when I was giving the old fungus a trial trip?"
"Of course, I'm telling you."
"Then who was the gal, I wonder?" mused the biscuit. "I don't remember seeing anything very special in the way of gals that time. However, don't let's wander from the point. You jumped into her car. What happened then?"
"You drove off, and we drove after you."
"You mean she just said, yes, sir, and trod on the self-starter? I should have thought she'd have called a cop and two loony doctors and had you put where you belonged."
Berry hesitated. They had reached the only point in this romance of his on which he did not like to let his mind dwell. No lover enjoys feeling that he is deceiving the girl he loves. There had been an instant during that scene in the supper room at the Mazarin when he'd braced himself for a full confession. He'd thought better of it, but nonetheless his conscience irked him. "Well, as a matter of fact, biscuit," he said, "I lied to her."
"Starting early, what?"
"I told her I was a Secret Service man," said Berry.
The biscuit gaped.
"You what?"
"I said I was a Secret Service man. You see, that explained why I wanted her to follow you."
"Why? Who did you say I was?"
"I told her you were the head of a great cocaine ring." The biscuit thanked him. "I had to give some reason for jumping into her car like that."
"And what happened when you told her you'd been fooling her?"
"I didn't."
"You let her go on thinking you were a Secret Service man?"
"Yes."
"God bless you, laddie. This is the best bedtime story I've heard for months and months and months. So she still thinks you're a Secret Service man.
You didn't explain later." "No, what happened was this, you see. When I came out of the inn, she'd gone. Her car wasn't there. She'd driven off. But tonight I met her again. There was a dance going on at the Mazarin, and I had come out from the dinner, and I saw her going up in the lift. So I went up after her and found her in the supper room. And we were just starting to talk when the man who was giving the dance came along and chucked me out." The biscuit uttered appreciative cries. "But before that happened, I had had time to see... I mean," said Berry, becoming incoherent, "there was something in her eyes. The way she looked, I believe, if only I had a minute longer, it was the way she looked, if you know what I mean."
"You clicked," said the biscuit, who liked his bedtime stories crisp.
Berry shuddered. The hideous phrase revolted him.
"I wish you wouldn't..." "Either a man clicks, or he does not click," said the biscuit firmly. "There are no half measures." "You did?"
"I think she was pleased to see me."
"Ah. Well, then, of course, you proceeded to ask her name."
"No."
"You didn't? I hadn't time." "Did you ask her where she lived?"
"No."
"Did she ask your name?"
"No."
"Did she ask where you lived?"
"No."
"What the dickens did you talk about?" asked the biscuit curiously. "Situation in Russia?"
Berry clenched his hands emotionally. Then a black recollection came to him and his face clouded.
"I found out one thing about her," he said. "She's engaged."
"Engaged?"
"Yes. I'm not worrying about finding her again. I know I shall find her. But if she's engaged..."
He broke off dejectedly, staring at the carpet.
"You feel
that a Conway should refrain from butting in and coming between this girl and some bloke unknown who no doubt loves her devotedly, said the biscuit.
Yes, all the same,
you jolly well mean to do it.
Yes,
quite right too.
Do you really think so?
Certainly, said the biscuit firmly. All's fair in love and war, isn't it? I seem to see this other bloke, a weedy bird with a receding chin and an eyeglass. I shouldn't give him another thought. Good heavens! One can't stop to consider the feelings of some unknown wart at a time like this. He's probably someone like Merwin Flock.
Who's Merwin Flock?
Oh, just a fellow, said the biscuit, just a blister who happens to be a sort of acquaintance of a friend of mine, from all accounts one of the less attractive types of human gumboil. Don't you worry, old boy. You take my tip and charge right ahead. There are enough difficulties confronting you already without your having to bother about any vague lizard in the background.
Berry bestowed upon his friend a look of the utmost gratitude and esteem. He had drawn much comfort from his words.
I'm glad you feel like that about it, he said. I'm glad you're glad, said the biscuit courteously.